You're listening to Bill Handel on demand from KFI AM 640.
Some people have had changes in behavior, hostility, agitation, depressed moods while taking or after stopping.
Bill Handel.
If you notice agitation, hostility, depression, or changes in behavior, thinking, or mood that are not typical for you, stop.
Bill Handel.
And call your doctor right away.
And now, here's Bill Handel.
KFI AM 640, live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. Bill Handel here, Friday morning, June 9th. And tomorrow at 7 o'clock in the evening, it's Unsolved, the new Unsolved segment with Steve Gregory. But first, Steve, I want to spend the first segment talking about aliens. Not the kind of aliens I did in the last segment,
yeah.
As in, you know, Martians flying around and landing on Earth in Nebraska hayfields. But I'm talking about the illegal, the migrants that have been flown into California, particularly Sacramento,
right.
And the politics around that. And we really don't know who did it, who paid for it. It's a wild story. So why don't you share with what you have?
Well, it's been pretty quiet since a week ago today, because that's when the first group of migrants were shipped from El Paso, Texas, over to New Mexico by bus, and then by plane, private charter, from New Mexico to Sacramento. And just a few days ago, the Secretary of State's office in Florida did confirm that it was the state of Florida that funded that trip. Now, Governor Newsom and State Attorney General Rob Bonta both, of course, were outraged and said this was nothing more than a political stunt. It was sickening, and they said that they're going to start investigating for possible criminal and or civil charges. But here's the interesting thing. So there's this subcontracting group out of Florida. It's based in Florida, that was hired to do this migrant relocation program that Ron DeSantis started last year. And that was the group that actually flew the first set of migrants up to Martha's Vineyard, into New York, into Portland. And what they were doing was dropping off these migrants in very democratically controlled major cities. So DeSantis has no problem apparently funding this operation, even though these migrants are in Texas and they're crossing the border illegally into Texas over the Rio Grande River. And the Texas governor, Greg Abbott's on board. He supports it as well. And I suppose there's probably some sort of a reciprocal funding agreement. But the issue is whether or not these migrants were coerced or lied to about this trip. Bonta claims that these migrants were lied to and made false promises. But then the migrants that actually got on the plane, some of them were interviewed and outside of a migrant center in El Paso were interviewed by the New York Times. And they said they couldn't wait to get to California, that they were excited to come to California. And they were anxious to get here because they know this state is very welcoming and they know there is great opportunity for them.
Okay, so this was not predicated on promises that were made to them. It's just they already knew California being a sanctuary state. But here I want to throw something at you. You've got a Texas governor who is funding or arranged to fund. Maybe it is money that is used by the state. I have no idea, because I know he's put out a $12 million program to send people up to various places. But a Texas governor a Florida governor,
yeah, yeah,
getting illegal or migrants out of Texas, going to New Mexico,
and
then flying them via private charter.
Yeah.
I mean, we've talked about how much money that is. That's tens of thousands of dollars each way, and you have to pay the airplane coming back also.
You know,
is that about?
Well, I have seen reports where Governor DeSantis and Greg Abbott, governor of Texas, they want to make a point. They really want to make a point. They're like, okay, if you think it's so easy on us down here in the border states, then here, have some. Here, you deal with it too. And I think that point was well taken in Martha's Vineyard and in New York City, because those two cities were ill-equipped to handle even the dozens of migrants that were dropped off there. But at issue, if you go back to what happened in Sacramento, so there was a shipment, a flight on Friday and another flight on this past Monday, for a total of 36 migrants that were dropped off in Sacramento. The problem is that apparently no one is warned that they're coming. I guess that's part of the pain point that these cities are experiencing is that they were not ready to receive these migrants. And so it makes it look a lot more inhumane. It makes it look a lot more treacherous. And so when they interviewed some of those migrants, they talked about the fact that there was confusion. They were dropped off in front of a church. There's nothing, you know, there was nothing for them. Where's the jobs? And I mean, so there was some confusion. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why Bonta and Governor Newsom are pretty outraged over it, because there was no coordinated effort. Now, let's not forget that this is not a new thing that happens when migrants are flown from border towns up to other parts of the country. That's been going on for the last 15 years in two other presidential administrations. So this is not a strange thing. The only difference is that those were pretty well coordinated efforts from the federal government.
And I'm assuming private charter is also pretty well, pretty rare.
Well, no. The federal government was chartering. They were chartering entire 737s. And, you know, because there was
That's 130 people.
Right. And there was a big criticism on that, too, because there was plenty of military transport available at no cost to the government. But there were lawmakers that said that it was too military. It looked too rough for migrants to be put on a military transport.
You know, what a cluster truck all of this is. It really is.
Well, here's the thing. It's very quiet now. And we did the story the other day, whether or not Bonta, you know, what happens next. And Bonta says, you know, we're prepared now, but now I don't know whether, you know, they plan
to. Prepared for what? When they arbitrarily fly someone and they take whatever little town, they take whatever church. It's like what happened in Washington, D.C. One of the flights or one of the buses dropped off a bus full of people right in front of the vice president's home.
Sure.
Here you go. And no one knew it was coming. You're right. That's a story.
Yeah, but here's the thing I'm going to point out, too. The governor of the Florida government says that these individuals sign waivers, and they do so under their own volition. So that's their defense. They say these people know what they're doing, they know what they're getting into, and they signed the waiver.
And even if that's true, they're still not telling anybody. They're not informing the church, for example, that they're going to drop off 15 or 20 or 35 migrants. I mean, the politics of this is
astounding. Well, is it illegal or unethical?
Well, certainly, it depends. Illegal, that's up in the air, and unethical, that's up in the air, depending on which side you're on this political situation. Tomorrow night, that's Saturday from 7 to 9 p.m., Unsolved, and it's a brand new segment. And everybody, well, at least I look forward to a new season. Steve, what's going on with this one?
Well, thank you, Bill. So tomorrow night, we're looking at the very odd death of a security guard in a grocery store in La Puente. We're going back to 2006. At approximately 10 o'clock in the evening, young men were seen going into the Northgate Gonzalez supermarket at 831 Hacienda Boulevard in La Puente. And they began mingling around, trying to blend in like customers. And then at some point, they disappeared. Well, the security guard was taking some stuff back to the rear of the store into a cooler, walk-in cooler area. Well, when he walked back there, apparently, this is a detective's assertion, that he surprised the four individuals. Apparently, these four guys were hiding out in the rear of the store so that when it closed, they could go back up to the front where the money's typically kept and steal the money. And then the security guard surprised him. And at some point along the way, there might have been a struggle. They don't know. But the security guard ended up stabbed 51 times. And
pretty brutal.
Yeah. 52 times. Excuse me. 52 times he ended up being stabbed in a break room. And then I saw the photos. Detective Sean McCarthy with LA County Sheriff's Homicide Bureau Cold Case Unit showed me the photos from the scene back in 06. It's brutal. This poor man is handcuffed with his own handcuffs. And then it's not clear whether he was stabbed before he was handcuffed or after he was handcuffed. But then his gun was taken from him. He had a gun, a registered firearm as a security guard. And then the gun was gone. So when detectives arrived, they pulled security footage. And I'm looking at here, I'll show you. This is these are screenshots from the security footage. And you can see that these guys are in there walking around. And at one point, you see, here's the really odd, strange thing about it. These four men go in, and they're clearly identified in surveillance footage, but there is footage of them coming down the stairs from a break room where the security guard was at in masks and gloves.
All right, so there's no face that is discernible. Can you see any faces?
There's one face in here that you can see closely there. There's one face that you can make out. And by the time they zoomed in, now think about it, going back to 06, that was back before high-def cameras were, you know, so plentiful. And in this kind of a market here, they didn't have a lot of cameras, but they had some. But they weren't high-def or HD cameras, so it was hard to make out a lot of detail. So detectives now, they are convinced that somebody or some people know who did this. It was four men, and this poor security guard, 52 times, and he was a part-time mechanic and a part-time security guard at this grocery store.
You know, I've asked you this before, but I want to go back to it. And that is, how many cold cases are sitting right now, for example, L.A. County sheriffs, where they couldn't figure out who it was. They haven't been solved. So I know you're looking on your phone, but all right. No. Can you ballpark it?
Well, the beginning of my show says that there's more than 10,000 unsolved cases in the region.
Wow. Okay. So with that, because this goes back 20, 30, 40 years. I know you've dealt with cases that are longer. So here we go. 10,000 cases. Here's one you're talking about. Here's another. And the number of unsolved, very, very few. And the number that are picked to be investigated are very few.
Yeah. And that's a manpower issue. The LA County Sheriff's Department has, you know, they don't have a funded cold case unit per se. What they do is they have hire backs. So retired detectives from the Homicide Bureau are hired back to work these cold cases, but with limited hours. And they have to reapply for the budget for these detectives. I believe it's only 10 detectives they bring back at a time in a year. And they have to reapply for that funding from the County Board of Supervisors every year. The problem is they are limited by hours. And once they max out on their hours for the week, they're not allowed to work on any more cases.
All right. So with that being said, out of 10,000 cases, who makes the choice? I'll take that case and not this case.
Yeah.
Is it detectives that have worked those cases or new people that worked those cases? What's the formula?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's one I keep asking all the time. And not just of the Sheriff's Department, but LAPD and San Bernardino Sheriff's Department, all these other agencies we've worked with. And it really boils down to they usually put a fresh pair of eyes on this in the cold case unit, and they may reach out to others, or they may create a task force where people from a district attorney's office might be involved now, and the sheriff and the police departments, and they put fresh eyes on it. And then they do an analysis. They look at this and they go, okay, well, it's been 23 years since we've taken a look at this case. Where are we at? And they look down the list. Now, the reason that cold case detectives are getting more excited is because a lot of these cases still have DNA evidence in a storage facility. And now with advancements in DNA, they're able to go back and give it another pass on the DNA, perhaps. So they look at cases that they can immediately sort of put new resources into or new manpower into. Something, I don't want to say that it's easier, but at least something that's a little more tangible to solve. Now, if you're talking about a cold case from 1951, something like that, they weren't storing DNA back in 1951. So they have to look at cases more pragmatically. Do they have the manpower for it? Do they have the resources for it? And how much evidence is there sitting in front of them? And some of the witnesses, are they all dead now? You know, they got to look at the witness list.
Also, someone was witnessing something that happened 25 years ago, and memories fade, they change, because as you and I have talked about, if you have 10 witnesses that have witnessed a crime, you have 11 different stories.
Correct. Exactly. And it takes time. And that's what people don't understand. That's the worst thing I am told all the time that Law and Order and CSI did to investigating, is because now everybody thinks that crimes are solved in 47 minutes without commercials.
Now, let me ask you something about DNA evidence, and I'm just throwing this at you.
Go ahead. Real quick.
Please.
Detective McCarthy just texted me and said there are 4,500 unsolved cases at the Sheriff's Department.
All right. I
4,500 cases. Think about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's extraordinary. Now, here's a question. And maybe when I know that a lot of detectives listen, a lot of police officers listen, because you're a huge, they're a huge fans of yours. And that is with DNA testing and AI, you would think that literally every case that has DNA evidence that they can just throw it into, and I think it's some kind of a, you know, machines that test for DNA.
Sure.
Assuming they don't look under a microscope, that it's some kind of a device. I know they do that with blood samples.
Right.
Are they going in that direction? Have you heard of that?
Sure. But here's the thing. How, you know, what's the integrity of the DNA sample? Has
right.
it degraded over the years or degraded over the years? And also familial DNA is another big part
right.
of this, too. And that's become a huge issue. And we're going to be talking with the FBI, I think, this season about it. There's a couple of cases of familial DNA is playing a role. But so to your question is, even though technology and science has made great advancements, it really boils down to how well the sample was preserved. And if there's enough of the sample to give a result.
And I'm looking at, and you've talked about this, that when they go through familial DNA to figure out who the suspect is, that's no small matter.
No.
That's a lot of investigation, isn't it?
No. It's and here's the thing. You remember, that's how the Grim Sleeper case was
right.
solved, because someone got familial DNA off of, I believe it was a slice of pizza. They found a relative, and they were able to backtrace from a relative's saliva on a piece of pizza.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank goodness that I didn't take that pizza as evidence. I would have eaten it. And you
of
know
course
that.
You would. Of course you would.
Steve, coming up tomorrow, it's the new Unsolved, tomorrow night, 7 to 9 p.m.
Yep.
And you can reach Steve at SteveGregory640.
That's right. Thanks, pal.
All right.
Have
thank
a great
you.
Weekend.
Looking forward to it. You too. And here we are. Handel and Neil Saavedra. It's Foodie Friday. He is host of the Fork Report tomorrow, 2 to 5 p.m., and his social address at Fork Reporter. Neil, good morning.
Good morning. Every time you mispronounce my name, I think 30 years I've known you,
yeah.
And then I pause and think, I've heard you mispronounce your own name.
That's true. I have mispronounced my
name
several
times.
So it
doesn't hurt my feelings anymore.
Thank you very much. Okay, we've got a lot to cover, and then we're going to spend the last couple of minutes talking to Jennifer, who is leaving us today.
Don't mention her name.
Yeah, I know. She who will not be mentioned.
Yes.
It's like Yawa. You can't mention the name.
Yeah, she's leaving us, and I'm sick of her happiness on her Instagram.
I know. It's driving us crazy. Okay,
all
let's
right,
start.
Buddy.
We all fly. And we've been bitching and moaning like crazy about how difficult it is. We're like sardines and the junk fees, et cetera. So when the airlines do give you food, which is very rare and few and far between now, what foods to avoid? And these are experts telling us, right?
Well, they are hands-on people. Let's say that. And I've heard this over and over, but these are coming from people that work on the plane. So they do have insights to this, and they are flying all the time. So they're going to, you know, tell you this is what we stay away from, often flight attendants or even pilots. But they don't normally give their names, and that's the case here in this story as well. And it's some of the same problematic foods over and over. The one that a lot of people don't think about, but I hear every single list one of these come out, and that is water. Because of the way the water is stored, if the pipes are not cleaned regularly on the plane, then the water that is stored in there is coming through dirty pipes. This is less of a problem with the United States than it is if you're flying to other places or flying on
because it's bottled water, right?
Well, bottled water is fine if you're getting bottled water, but if you're getting coffee, tea, or ice in your drinks,
Got it.
That's not coming from the bottle at
yeah.
all. So it depends on that. Now, some of the airlines are much better than others, and there's been tests that have gone over to see, you know, to test the quality of the water. And so, it like I said, it's less a problem for us, but, you know, they say that JetBlue and Spirit Air ranked the last, whereas Alaska Airlines and Allegiant Air offered the safest right. water. So it depends.
All right. Now, if you're going overseas at all, virtually every airline over there serves meals. When talking about food, and this one we don't talk very much about, although I've seen television shows about this, because I really like that, is the fact that people's taste buds are very different at 35,000 feet.
Yeah, similarly to when foods are hyperheated or hyperchilled, the way we experience them is different, and our body changes when you're in a floating tube that is pressurized. And so what ends up happening is, to compensate for our lack of taste in that environment, they add a lot of salt. So anything that would normally have salt in it has much more salt in it so that you can taste it. There are also things like cheese trays that might have hyper-processed cheese on them to last longer. I mean, it's not a great process. They usually have one massive kitchen that are pre-cooking these things, and then they're shipped off to the plains, driven to the plains, and then they're reheated. That's why you can't, if you get a filet mignon or a steak of any kind, you can't say, I want it medium rare. They're all going to be overcooked. It's just the process in which they do it. So some of it's going to be concerns for your health, and then some of it's going to be, hey, it's just going to be garbage. Like, meat is going to be overcooked, and it's not going to taste good. But there are some things like that cheese or the water that you want to stay away from. Alcohol is a horrible idea on a plane, and it's very strange that they sell it, because the way your body reacts again in that environment is you will feel like you're much more drunk than you would with the same amount of alcohol on the ground. So, you know, that's why people are freaking out, maybe.
All right. Worst foods to bring to the beach, because we're about to have beach weather, and I am going to take some guesses. All right. Number one, sloppy joes are not good for the 5-second rule at the beach.
Yeah. I'd stay away from sloppy joes, pudding, jello, things like that. Probably not so great. This is a funny list, but I think that there's smart things to it, because when it comes to humans, I don't know why we do this, but we understand that certain foods that are perishable need to be in the refrigerator or need to be cooked. But when we have picnics or we go to the beach or we have a cookout, whatever it might be, for some reason, we think it's totally legitimate to keep these things in the 90-degree weather for 4 hours and it's going to be okay. We just lose all sensibility because it's like, we're at the beach. What could happen? So the danger zone that we've talked about over and over again, that is in between 40 degrees and 140 degrees. In that region, food doubles its bacteria every 20 minutes. So it can make you sick. That danger zone is about 2 hours before everything should be tossed out. But in 90-degree weather outside, it's about an hour. So keeping in mind that when you're bringing things like meat, you probably in your head go, okay, bring it in frozen form. Then we can throw it on the grills that are provided at many beaches, and we can do that. But people don't often think about fresh produce, because health experts say that fruits and veggies might not be your best at the beach, because leafy greens like a salad, cut tomatoes, even cut melon, that once they're cut, they have an environment that is perfect for bacteria to grow. Often people put them in clear containers, which basically becomes, you know, this greenhouse for heat. And it ends up creating that warm, moist, damp environment that all this stuff starts to, you know, grow. And juice that is produced by these things also get, they're very, very tempting and hospitable to your bacteria. Uncooked meat is obvious. Keep that in mind. You have to have it in a cooler. You should keep it, uncooked meat, in a separate cooler from everything else, preferably bringing it, you know, frozen if they're patties and cooking it on there. But you don't want to do that again with poultry. So it really depends on on how good you are at preparing, prepping, and keeping these things chilled on the way.
All right, I'm going to stop you right now. Hang loose, because I want to bring Jennifer in today. Yeah, exactly. That's, you know what? Coming Monday, that's exactly what we're going to say. Jennifer Jones Lee, today is her last broadcast here at KFI. And beyond that, her last broadcast as a newscaster on the radio. I'm trying to be obnoxious, but it's going to be difficult to do, because I know you've already said goodbye, and it's cloying, and it's, too much this morning. But why don't you tell us where you are going and what happened and how, that you haven't been fired, which everybody who leaves radio stations get fired.
Everybody gets fired, but it just shows that I'm going out on a good note here. It's not that I wanted to leave at all. It's that my dad got sick about a year ago, and then my grandmother passed away a few months later, and then Scott and I got a divorce, and all of a sudden, by about summertime last year, I was like, what the hell? And so it was January when it was after the holidays, and my parents had come down to visit, and they went home, and my heart started to hurt. You know, I was feeling like, man, I really need to get back there and see my family, and almost losing my dad, and very much I'm a daddy's girl. That priority came into play big time. And so I kind of threw it out there in the universe. And turns out there was a position that I'm going to get to take. I'm hanging up the headphones. I'm staying in radio, but now I'm going to be operations manager of a 5 radio station cluster in Reading. And what's amazing about this is one of the stations that I will be managing is where I got my start in radio back when it used to be a country station when I had graduated high school. So this is 30 years in the business for me, starting at, it was B94 back in the day. It is still 94.7 there, but I'm going back to that station, which still creeps me out. And I found the t-shirt that I got from that station back in the day. I'm wearing that on my first day of work.
How cool. And
it's cool.
From what you had said, you're actually going to be the boss of people who trained you, right?
Yeah, which is wild.
It is wild.
And
I can't.
It's the, not only the people who trained me, so it's the on air, it's the sales staff. One of the women who is one of my best friends gave me my first remote.
Oh, wow.
I mean, and it was at a, we sat in a, this is so Reading, we sat in a boat in a parking lot. And we were pushing the marine, whatever it was called back in the day. And so that's it. When I called my family and I said, oh, my God, you guys, I got this job opportunity. It also, my uncle goes, well, hey, I have a house that's vacant. If you want that, he flips houses. I was like, oh, my God. So now I have a house. I have a job. I get to go be with my family. And I have started seeing my college boyfriend again after 30 years.
It's all coming together. Do me a favor.
I can't believe it.
Do me a favor. When you are up there, your first day, which I know is in a couple of weeks, go to the staff that you used to work for and say, remember when I was subservient to you? Those days have changed.
No, I feel like I can't really do too much of that because they know all the secrets.
Yeah.
Like they know where the bodies are buried.
Right. So today is a pretty auspicious day.
I just really quickly to you how much I'm not blowing smoke because honestly, I'd like to be a smart ass to you, but I can't. You have given me such an opportunity to be part of your show, to attach myself to you early on. You trusted in me, and for that, I am forever grateful. And you know what? Everybody has asked me, is he really that mean? This guy has the biggest heart.
Yeah,
it's deep down in there, but you know what, Handel? I love you. You're like my family.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Whether you want to be or not, you're stuck with me, kid.
Yeah, I don't want to be.
But thank you.
Thank you for
and
that.
And Neil, thank you for everything. Thank you for putting up with me, and you guys, I don't know. It's just not going to be the same without you.
No, it is not.
Leave here with great feelings. Yeah.
Jen, you're the best. You brought a lot of light and a lot of joy here in addition to the ratings and the spirit. And I told Robin recently, just before the Pastathon, that the way people loved to see you, that you are the best ambassador for the station.
Aww.
So you're now a son of a bitch.
we are going to miss it.
Her life, have you seen it on Instagram?
Yeah,
her life. I want to take her to Vegas before she goes there. Yeah. because of all the good luck and everything she's got going, it really is a blessing. And God bless you, my friend.
And thank
go
you and you.
And find your joy.
I love you guys. Thank you.
Of course you do. Jen, what I want to do is end with this. And I have said this. This is not blowing smoke. I have done this show in the morning for 30 years. And I have said, you're the best news person we've had. And that is legitimate. And I had to read that on the contract, but I still believe it. All right, Jen, we'll talk again, of course.
We will talk again.
You have to call in, and we'll see how you're doing.
And you all are invited up to Reading.
Of course we are.
I'm going to take your fishing handle.
Yeah,
you can meet my donkeys.
Yeah, exactly. We'll have 3,000 people up there. All right, Jen, you know, have a good life.
As, thank you, Handel,
they
you
say.
Too.
Coming up, Mark Thompson, Layla Muhammad. This is KFI AM 640 live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.
You've been listening to The Bill Handel Show. Catch my show Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. and anytime on demand on the iHeartRadio app.